I'm Jay Moran.
I'm Bridget Jaipal Valenza.
I'm Thomas O'Neill White.
We need to get together and let our voices be heard.
This is What's Next. A dedicated hour to have important conversations about the issues facing the marginalized and underrepresented communities of Western New York and Southern Ontario.
If we're going to have some real healing, we've got to have space to tell some uncomfortable truth.
What's Next continues our mission to discuss race,
equity,
and the common concerns of Buffalo's East Side and beyond.
In the suburban area, everywhere, we must work and teach our children.
This is What's Next. I'm host Thomas O'Neill White, and today we are talking art and an installation that has gained a large following over the last few months. The Blues, a 514 Community Memorial, an art installation honoring the victims of 514. Joining me today is Initiative Project Coordinator Brendan Bannon and writer Josh Thermidor. Thank you both for being with us today.
Thank you.
Thanks for having us.
So, Brendan, how did the project get started? What was the inspiration behind it?
Like Josh and like others who are facilitating the project, I was photographing the aftermath of 514. And I had been on the ground photographing and, you know, kind of having that experience as a journalist. And like many projects, I kind of find a way to step in after the fact to continue the work, to continue to try and create meaningful connections in community. And through work that I do in something called the Odyssey Project, a program for combat veterans, I was in close contact with people at the National Endowment for the Arts. In a meeting, I heard about a project they were doing in Uvalde, and the massacre in Uvalde happened a couple weeks after the massacre here in Buffalo. Mm-hmm. And I asked, you know, what about Buffalo? And it was turned back around and kind of encouraged to come up with an idea of something to do that used art to mediate trauma and to work in community that had been subjected to hate-fueled violence. The National Endowment for the Arts is interested in supporting those programs, and so I proposed this, and it was approved for a special leadership grant given to the project through SEPA Gallery in Buffalo.
And so did you immediately think flags, or what was the process behind figuring out like what type of art to use? Because it also isn't just flags, it's also haikus, and we can get into that in a little bit.
So the flags are made with the cyanotype process. It's an age-old photographic process that uses light-sensitive iron salts to render an image. And one of the initial kind of thoughts was in the days after 514, there was the police tape everywhere, there were flowers encased in cellophane that people had left, and there was a lot of wind. So to me, I immediately thought of the kind of soundscape that was there and how haunting that was to remember it and recall it. That combined with this idea of making cyanotype flags that would transform that sound into something that was visually striking and beautiful kind of informed the idea. Cyanotypes are blue. Blues is a traditional musical form which transforms suffering, anxiety, depression into art. And so it's kind of a combination of all of those things that came together pretty quickly in my mind with this visual idea of presenting an overwhelming amount of flags as vessels for people's feelings, thoughts, and emotions. And so we created a series of workshops where community members could work together to facilitate workshops for other community members. And in each workshop, create space for thousands of people to make their own flags as a testament to how they think and feel about what happened.
So talk to me about the initial workshop. Was it overwhelmingly positive? Was there like immediate buy-in from the community? Or was there some like, well, what is this?
I think we moved at the speed of trust through this project, and we moved kind of quietly and gently in the beginning. And you'll hear later from Cheryl Manny from the King Urban Life Center, who's had us out a number of times, Josh Thermidor, who's sitting next to me now, is really influential early in helping to build the crew of facilitators, but also in kind of conceptualizing an approach that uses writing and has another dimension to it beyond just the visual. And with all of those small steps in the beginning, I think we've been able to build a project that resonates with the community and feels to the community like it's theirs.
Yeah, so Josh, let's bring you in, brother. Tell us about the spoken word component of this project.
Yeah, I think that poetry initially just seemed like something that absolutely had a place in this project. And when Brendan sort of explained to me what the sort of function of the poetry would be, and, you know, we considered the constraints of what the size of these flags were going to be, I really wanted to keep things simple, but I also wanted the simplicity to lend itself to almost like a lean muscle, you know, something that was like really ready to expand and contract and do everything that it had to do effectively for the community. It had to serve the needs of the people who were utilizing it. And so the haiku really seemed perfect because it's a form that it tested against time. It's lasted for so long and it's traveled through so many hands. You know, of course, originally in the hands of age-old Japanese poets like Busan and Kobayashi Isa and these sort of masters of the Japanese form. But the interesting thing about the haiku, and everybody knows like the sort of 5-7-5 thing, and it doesn't have to rhyme. But the thing that I found interesting about the haiku that made it sort of intrinsically related to what we were trying to do is that the haiku comes out of a time when these poets are actually writing these longer form poems called Renga sequences. And so poets would come together and actually that 5-7-5 would actually be 5-7-5, 5-7-5, 5-7-5 over and over and over again. Each poet would contribute or they would collaborate together to write these longer sequences. And so by having these flags, which would ultimately be bound together with these 5-7-5 sequences, it was almost like we were sort of participating in this sort of transcendent history of this form, doing something that the form has always done. And it just felt perfect for the project. And it also felt perfect because it's small enough that it's not as intimidating for the people who we were collaborating with. You know, it's just got to be able to count. And we gave them, we even designed a word bank. And so at the point of resistance, you could turn to the word bank and be like, okay, I need a word that's 2 syllables. I need a word that's 3 syllables. And so I can just plug that in here and I can find something that matches my emotion. And then I can allow the haiku to be a catalyst for what I'm feeling and what I want to express.
When you were collecting the flags, were there certain emotions that stood out to you that people had put on the flags or conveyed through that art form?
I think one that sticks out to me still was when Brendan and I did the first workshop at Performing Arts. And it's one that I'm so incredibly impressed by. And it really, really encapsulated the fact that, you know, I saw this one and I was like, we're doing something right. It was a student had at the top of their cyanotype had put a timestamp and it was like 000, like 0 o'clock almost basically. And so that was like the title of their cyanotype. And the rest of the haiku was formatted like a text message. And it was like, no eggs today. It was basically like a conversation between a person who was at the store and a person who was not at the store. And the last line of it was, my last text to you.
Oh, geez.
And so they were able to sort of like, that's a real sort of exploration, a real sort of like, I feel like it's a great distance that the thing travels through, because that student, they weren't just thinking about, oh, I'm writing a haiku. They took something that could very well have been a reality of that situation. And they allowed the form to exist in a form that we would understand in the sense of the text message. And I think that was, for me, the emotion that I felt in that was, you know, this sort of almost like stale, kind of still sadness of just like everything that was held in that. And just imagining like those being the last words that you receive from someone. And I think that the sort of, you know, just I think a feeling that just traveled through the entire project was sadness. But like we lost elders in that tragedy. And so a real sense of like being without, being bereft, you know, almost as though like everyone who was making a cyanotype was grieving a family member. And some people were grieving family members, actually. And so I think that was a consistent emotion that held true.
We've got about 5 minutes left. I just want to bring up 514, you know, pretty big press event out in front of the Johnny B. Wiley Pavilion. Can you talk a little bit about that day and having those flags hung up in front of the pavilion and having the mayor's office, a lot of local politicians and business leaders coming out to not only honor the victims of 514, but to honor what you guys have done here?
I think it was really a remarkable day to be present to. There were thousands of voices of school kids, of elders, of people in nursing homes and special needs classrooms who were represented in the flags that were fluttering over us and over the dignitaries of the city and the county and the state. And those voices, you know, to know that those voices were being amplified by an event like that was really remarkable. You know, like this show, like that moment, I wish that people could see, and they will be able to by going out and looking at the flags, just how many people have come together to say what they need to say about the loss, about the struggle, about overcoming, about community. One of the biggest motifs that happens over and over again in the workshops is about community. You know, and there are high school students who are talking about the value of community in overcoming their grief and trauma. And, you know, I think that that was a demonstration of what's in so many flags. People really understanding that art can be a valuable way for people to heal, a valuable way for people to address the unspeakable and to have their thoughts and emotions recognized.
Josh?
So I was not here for the event. I was actually away at school, but definitely I had mixed emotions for sure. I was over the moon and incredibly proud of everyone that had just like worked so hard, and to see it culminate in the city sort of, in the city seeing all the work that they had done, and the city seeing all the work that their constituents had done, that their community members had done. You know, this is a hard-nosed city, a steel city. It's a city of, and so, you know, when I say that, I say that it's a city about tangibles. I think it's a city that the people, they want things, they know how to hold things in their hands. They know, you know, they've got blisters and they can hold things, and they understand what it means to walk through the fire and to come out on the other side. And I think that, if anything, the feeling of seeing all of that come together, I hope that our community leaders and our elected officials take that serious, and moving forward, they just see that, you know, these people need things in their hands. Like, all we did was we just facilitated. We gave people the tools, we put materials in their hands, and they made the things themselves. And I think that that's emblematic and that's representative of everything that the city's capable of.
All right, Brendan and Josh, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
That was Brendan Bannon and Joshua Thermidor with the Blue Flags Memorial. Up next is Jay Moran with Bob James and Carolyn Damon.
You're listening to What's Next, our place to discuss the important issues of our communities of Western New York and Southern Ontario. We want to hear from you. Click on the Talk to Us option in the WBFO app, and we will work to get your questions or comments on the air. Do you have a story or concern that we should be addressing? Email us using whatsnext@wbfo.org. Together, we'll have the conversations that are needed. This is WBFO, your NPR station.
Welcome to What's Next. Today, we're going to talk about mental health first responders. With us, Bob James. We've talked to Bob before from Western New York Vets. Bob himself, a former crisis services outreach worker. Bob, thanks for joining us again.
Yes, sir. It's so great to be here. Thank you for having us.
And Carolyn Damon, supervisor for Spectrum Cares. Hi, Carolyn.
Hi, how are you?
So, Carolyn, you're in the supervisor business, and we talk about mental health first responders. Talk about just the people that want to do this work, that come to find this way in the work. Maybe even share a little of your experience, how you came across doing this.
Sure. I started in crisis work back in 2008 as an outreach worker at Crisis Services. I had no experience in crisis work prior to then. I worked in residential centers, I worked in schools, but I had never done crisis work per se.
Right.
So that was very eye-opening. And it was such a great experience that I keep coming back to crisis work. Right. So even though I left outreach, I found my way back to Spectrum Cares. And now I do the same type of work with the 17 and under population.
17 and under, huh?
Mm-hmm.
There's got to be a significant difference, I would think, to a certain extent. Or maybe not. Maybe I'm jumping to conclusions that what 17 and unders are dealing with are a little bit different than adults.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. The issues certainly are different. The way you have to go about it is also different.
Okay.
Because when you have an adult client, you can talk to that client one-on-one. You don't have to get permission from anyone. You don't have to ask for consent from anyone.
Right.
You can just go out and do what you need to do to complete your assessment.
Right.
When it's children, you have to get permission from legal guardians. You have to get families involved. There's usually a treatment team of some sort, either school-based counseling or outpatient counseling. So there's a few more layers with the children just because of the age and that lends to that. But as far as issues that I see with the kids these days, so much of it involves social media, school, bullying, cell phone usage.
We keep going back to the phone, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, there's just so much, and it causes so much anxiety and depression and exacerbates their suicidal ideations if they have them. And it's a lot that they're struggling with.
At the same time, though, so then you know the problems are different. Well, what about, and you know, you have to go through these layers, especially when it comes to young people. Well, once you're through all that, your approach, is it different with a younger person than an older person?
I would say so.
Okay.
With adults, I think you can be a little bit more blunt and direct most of the time when you're out to address the concerns. Sometimes with kids, especially depending on the age, you have to finesse things a little bit, especially with the younger ones. If you're going to assess a kid who's like 4, 5, 6 years old, they may not even understand what suicide is.
Right.
And you have to find words and ways to explain it to them so that they understand. When you get into the older teenagers, it's a little bit different. You know, they have a better understanding. And usually when you go to see them, they know why you're there.
Right.
So it's easier to be a little bit more direct with them.
Bob, I heard you agreeing with a couple of things that Carolyn said there. Was your experience as well?
Well, yes, it was. And I think how it worked when I was at Outreach, and it was a long time ago that I was there, and we were talking a little bit about Carolyn and I were talking earlier about how the technology has changed.
Yeah.
You don't have a beeper on your bedside table like we did back in the 80s that would go off in the middle of the night, but you have a cell phone. So when you're on call, it still comes in through a different technological tool. But once you get in your car and you go out to the situation, the crisis, to intervene, I think those skills haven't really changed in the current times. I think the basic thing about staying focused, knowing why you're there, having a team member you can rely on to make a determination. One example might be an elderly person that has fallen and they live alone and they have a neighbor that knows that they've fallen and they've hurt themselves and they have maybe a broken hip and they're declining that they have anything wrong with them. You know, ambulance might be called and can't determine what's going on. They think there might be something that's psychological or mental about it. So they call the crisis team to go out and make an intervention to assess a couple things. Is there risk involved? And is there some evidence of mental illness? If somebody might be delusional or hallucinating, or there's some evidence of mental illness paired with risky behaviors, then the team has the authority to be able to kind of really nudge someone and sometimes call the police and have somebody transported for an evaluation. So that's one example. Memories I have of some of the outreach visits were going into a house, and very often elderly people living alone. I remember a couple of visits where the person had been hoarding stuff. And the only way to get from the front of the house to the back of the house was a little pathway along the floor where everything was heaped up to the walls to get from one end to the other. So didn't make an intervention. That's some evidence of some risks, some health risks, and we get a blitz team that comes in once the person's
blitz team? Gotten. What's a blitz
team? A blitz team is what it was called back then. Somebody will come in from the health department and assist cleaning up somebody's house so it's more habitable.
All right. Okay.
You know, so they'll take all the stuff out there and make it, cleaned it up, and get the person back in the home to sustain them living in the community. But it might be some evidence of mental illness that people, you know, this is a whole different science in terms of why people hoard stuff and save newspapers that go back 20 and 30 years and go to almost junkyards and get stuff to fill up their houses. And those are things where the team would make an intervention, make an evaluation to determine what would be the best outcome, the way to support the person, kind of maintaining the level of health. So that's just a couple of different examples of the kind of things that we would see. And I would say for me, my capacity to have genuine, deep compassion came from doing that kind of work, seeing people that have kind of fallen through the cracks of the system and they're out on the, kind of the fringe in terms of what might be considered healthy on a lot of different levels. You really see people that you wouldn't see otherwise without doing this kind of work. So you develop a sense of compassion. And when Carolyn was talking earlier, I thought, parents that have a child that has a very, very high fever, let's say 104 degrees,
right,
people know that as parents. But when you have another parent with you, it's much easier to stay calm and make a decision on what to do. But imagine if you're alone with a child like that, it's more of a sense of urgency and life and death in a crisis. So the beauty of working with teams is that you have somebody you can step outside if you have a moment to do that and make a decision on what's the best response we can use or we could bring to this situation.
Appreciate Bob's story.
I've said a lot here.
No. I appreciate what you said there, Bob. And I'm going to turn kind of to Carolyn the same way. And we talked about this before we went on the air, that this would be a great opportunity to share some stories. And we want to make sure that we do our best to keep anonymity, of course. But how about for you, Carolyn? Is there a story from when you think of your career of dealing with, you know, crisis outreach, being a mental health first responder? Is there a story that kind of solidified your experience and made you know that, A, you know, you're doing some important work here, and B, that there was a reward for you and that there's a certain sense of personal, I don't know if satisfaction is the right word, but that the connection that happens when you know that you're doing the right work?
Yeah. I honestly don't know if I could pick one mm-hmm. single story.
Right.
There are so many.
Yeah.
I think to piggyback on what Bob was saying, we did see that a lot in crisis services, especially with the elderly population,
right,
because a lot of times they have medical issues that mimic psychiatric issues.
Okay.
So a lot of times we would get called out and we would have to make a clinical determination as to whether or not does that fall under mental health or is that a medical issue that they need to be seen by a physician, not a psychiatrist.
Right.
Those are always interesting. The hoarding, obviously, to have a peek at somebody's life and how they live and to see how their OCD has manifested into the hoarding situation. There was actually a client I went to see last week in CARES, and it was kind of a full circle moment for me because when I had worked in a previous role at a different agency, I had worked with this girl. She was about 5-6 years old at the time.
Yeah.
And I knew when I was leaving there, she was in the midst of getting removed from her family. Fast forward to last week, and I happened to go out to see someone, didn't recognize the name. She's in foster care, having some suicidal ideations. Mm. They weren't sure how to best assist her. Turns out it was the same little girl that I knew from when
wow.
she was 5-6 years
wow.
old.
Oh my gosh.
I knew her mom. I knew her siblings. I was able to use that history that I had with her to safety plan and keep her at home and not have to go to the hospital.
Did she remember you when you saw her?
When I kind of jogged her memory and I was like, you remember I was at your house like every other week and I worked with your brother? And then she was like, oh my gosh. So yeah, that.
Oh, good. Okay.
And so yeah. that helped with the situation.
I think it helped the whole situation and the whole crisis that we were dealing with at that moment. Just having that connection and knowing like that's somebody that I recognize in my life.
So there's no substitute. Well, there is a substitute for experience, but experience pays off in these situations.
For sure. Yeah, you never know when you're going to come back in contact with someone that you've helped before.
What about keeping people with experience? Is that a struggle? What about this particular aspect of dealing with people being a mental health first responder?
I would say the nice thing right now about Spectrum Cares is that myself and the other two supervisors that are there, our director and our program manager, all three of us worked at Crisis Services Outreach together.
Okay.
So we all have that experience.
Right, right.
And we all really enjoy this field, so that's why we're all still here.
Sure.
I think the team that we have now definitely has a decent amount of experience. They're younger, but they're building. I think it's a type of work that you have to find out if it's for you. And I think some people do it and they find out it's definitely not for me. So I think that's where the turnover rate comes in sometimes with the crisis work. But I think once you find those people who really have that passion and the love for it that we do, you tend to stick with it because that's kind of your thing.
Right. With us, Bob James and also Carolyn Damon. And we're talking about mental health first responders, those people who are out there who go into situations where they've got to make decisions about people and their current situations and make recommendations. I'll throw this out to both of you. What is the disposition that makes an ideal person to do this type of work? Or are there many factors involved there?
I don't know. It's almost like a chicken and egg situation. Do you develop a sense of resilience from the work, or do you have a sense of resilience that leads you to do the work? I don't know. Right. But I know that having done the work for a while, you develop a sense of resilience because you have to stay focused and stay in the moment and work closely with another person that sometimes you may not agree in terms of what the best outcome might be. But you have to work out a solution between two people in terms of what the best response might be.
Any expansion on that thought, Carolyn?
I think I tend to agree. I'm not sure which comes first either. I do think you have to have a real passion for the unknown and uncertainty and every day being different. And I think some people who really prefer a routine and like going into the office and knowing what to expect every day and what is going to happen, maybe that's not for them.
Right.
But if you like a change and you like a fast pace and you like not knowing where your day is going to lead, this is the job for you.
Sure. Well, then let's
that's a really good point.
You intrigue me about that. So let's talk about the day. Let's just say, you know, you go... You go to an office to start the day, then what's going to happen? You might be sitting for hours?
I mean, there are days, yeah, especially we tend to be busier during the school year because we get a lot of calls from school counselors, school social workers, principals, that kind of thing. During the summer, sometimes there's not as much going on, and sometimes it's a little bit quieter, but somebody's always having a crisis somewhere.
Right.
And we are always needed somewhere.
Right.
So yeah, there's days I will walk in the office at 9 a.m. and I could be out the door to a school in Akron. And then when we finish there, we might get a call and say, okay, now you have to go out to Gowanda on the other side of Erie County.
Right.
And you have to go out there and do an assessment. You really never know where you're going to go.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
Or where the day will take you.
Is that kind of your experience too,
Bob? Yeah. I mean, yeah. There were days where we would go in and never sit down.
Yeah.
Come in and up on the board. And again, this is back in the 80s. Up on the board.
We still use the board.
With chalk or with markers, erasable markers. There'd be a list of ACT open cases. And I think it is the same way that people can call 834-3131, talk to a crisis phone counselor 24/7. And then if it looks like a situation that needs to get referred to for a potential outreach visit, it gets referred to that team. Then they make the assessment. And then you make a determination, does something need an immediate visit? Does it need follow-up or whatever? And this is, again, this is back in the 80s in terms of how it operated. But then you'd never know when you walk into the work what was on the board for that day. Well, we did need to do a follow-up visit to this situation because it's not imminent, but it needs follow-up. We need to go back out and see if this situation has resolved itself. Sometimes we'd go, like Carolyn said, you go from one visit to the next, you'd go all over Erie County and off to the edges of Erie County as well sometimes. And you'd see situations in inner city that were very different than situations rural. That were way out where they were rural. And one wasn't more crisis than the other. It's based on what was happening in the community. Sometimes, and this is an essential thing to learn and to understand, is sometimes you need the police involvement.
I was just going to ask about that.
And there's an authority that master's level people get from Mark O'Brien, who's a friend of ours, who's the commissioner of mental health, former outreach worker, called the 945 authority. It gives you the permission. It's part of New York State mental hygiene law. It gives you permission to authorized involuntary. She's got her card right there. I lost mine when I left crisis services, which is fine. But you call the police and they would preside over a transport for somebody to go to ECMC. And I'm not sure in the rural areas if they would go to someplace else.
For Erie County, the only place we go is ECMC these days.
It's a designated recipient.
Carolyn, you're doing a nice job of, you know, obviously you love your work and what you do, but there's a huge responsibility. You're going to make a decision here, a recommendation on people that could potentially be life-changing.
Oh, yeah, for sure. I don't think it's anything that you can ever take lightly.
Right.
When you go out, you have to be focused. You have to be objective. You have to look at exactly what's going on. Is this person an imminent danger to themselves or somebody else? Are they safe to be able to remain in the community? Or do they need to be taken over to the hospital and seen by a psychiatrist to make a further determination on that? It's a huge responsibility. And I think it's something that we all definitely take very seriously. And we all do our best to make sure that we make the best clinical assessment in that moment.
Is that interesting story you told us about the youngster who was a six-year-old foster child, and then you met up with the individual later on. In that case, you did get to see maybe an outcome of sorts.
Right, right.
Do you always?
No, not always. No. The nature of crisis work is very short-term. Mm-hmm. So we are called in usually only when there is a situation or a crisis. So our main goal is to go in, mitigate that crisis, make sure everyone is safe, and then we usually close out involvement. Most of the time, though, that individual is linked with long-term services.
Okay.
So they have ongoing services. We are just there to help with the crisis aspect.
Short-term. At the same time, the information occasionally floats back to you, what happened to somebody?
Oh, yeah. I mean, there are always those clients, whether it was in outreach or now in CARES, there's always clients that you end up getting kind of an update on and, oh, remember so-and-so, and, you know, they're doing great now, or...
That's got to be very satisfying.
Yeah, it's rewarding to know that, years down the line, somebody that I saw is actually doing well.
This has been quite the conversation. Mental health first responders. Is that your own term there, Bob? I think it is.
I'm
not sure. I thought about how can we title this in a way. So we talked about with Crisis Services and Spectrum, we talked a little bit about what the handle is. And the handle is... same thing, like I said, fire and police and military and emergency, you know, EMTs and all that, not EMTs, emergency, you know, ambulance drivers.
Yeah, EMTs.
They're all,
sure.
Okay, yeah. Thank you. They're all considered first responders. And a friend of mine who's actually, I'm not going to name by name, was saved by a fire company first responder not that long ago. The first responders save lives, and it's not overly dramatic to say that. And in mental health these days, more and more, there's that need for those kinds of people to be available 24/7 to go out wherever, whenever, to help resolve a crisis and save lives.
Well, Bob James, Western New York Vets, of course, we've known you from that before, and also from your time at Crisis Services and Outreach Worker. Thanks for being with us,
back
sir.
Back in the day, yeah.
Absolutely. And Carolyn Damon, Supervisor at Spectrum Cares. Thank you for being with us.
Thank you so much.
And also want to remind anybody who is listening to this program right now, if they are undergoing a certain type of stress themselves, the Suicide Prevention Line, National 988.
Right.
And, of course, if you know someone else who could use that as well. But the bottom message is there are many people out there willing to help you, and hopefully you can find that help.
That's hopeful.
Yes. Stay with us. There's more to come. This is What's Next on WBFO.
Public media is more than Morning Edition and Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me. Buffalo, Toronto Public Media creates digital series to ignite curiosity in young learners, free lesson plans, videos, and training for teachers and parents, and events to empower the minds of our community's next generation. This is Public Media.
You're listening to What's Next, our place to discuss the important issues of our communities of Western New York and Southern Ontario. We want to hear from you. Click on the Talk to Us option in the WBFO app, and we will work to get your questions or comments on the air. Do you have a story or concern that we should be addressing? Email us using whatsnext@wbfo.org. Together, we'll have the conversations that are needed. This is WBFO, your NPR station.
We are back with more What's Next. I'm host Thomas O'Neill White, and today we are talking art, an installation that has gained a large following over the last few months. Blues, a 514 Community Memorial Initiative. Joining me are facilitators Caitlin Lowe, Brandon Watson, Ebony White, and Cheryl Williams Manny from King Urban Life Center. Thank you all for being with me today.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Let's go back to the second anniversary of 514, the press event with the mayor's office, a lot of local politicians, business leaders from all across Western New York were there. It was a pretty big deal. Brandon, you had the chance to talk and you described this initiative as a unifying force. Can you get a little bit more into that?
Yeah, it absolutely is a unifying force. I mean, it brought me here with these three lovely ladies that I'm with today. And also each and every single event that we go to is an opportunity to meet with members of the community, speak with members of the community. And even though we might come from different backgrounds, we all kind of come with the same initiative and the same goal of putting these messages together. And it's always exciting to get an opportunity to meet people and connect in ways and share a lot of, you know, what we've been feeling since 2022 of May 14th. And getting those thoughts out there.
And I asked Josh this same question when y'all were collecting all of the cyanotypes. Like, when you read them, were there certain emotions that stood out to you from the art that was made? What the community was saying through that art?
Yeah, absolutely. Because I think you got every single range of it. And that, I think that was one of the things that was like the most insightful, is that, you know, some people made very positive messages, but some people were angry and deservedly so. And then some people also talked about just still living in that fear. There was a young girl at Leonardo da Vinci High School who was telling us that she grew up a block away from the Tops on Jefferson Avenue, and how she just kept thinking about how she was happy that she moved away. I think that's like one of those things that like always stands out, because she was just like, had she had not moved away, she might have been there that day. And I think that that's real for everyone that still living in the inner city of Buffalo. We're still feeling a lot of different emotions, and I don't think that,
right,
you know that it still continues. Yeah.
What about you, Caitlin?
I definitely agree with Brandon. I feel like, okay, honestly, I can be a little pessimistic sometimes. So
join the club.
So I think that it's a nice thing to have a memorial where people are sending positive messages into the atmosphere. But my mind and my heart gravitate a little bit more towards people who are questioning, and people who are like, I'm not resolved from this, or people who kind of like take more of an artistic interpretation. There was somebody who graduated college with his master's degree, and like, we went to his job, he had a plaque on his desk, and he went to go get it, and he's trying to figure out like, how am I gonna do this? Can you guys help me? I'm not really creative. And his whole piece was about the fact of, how can I celebrate myself and my achievements when this is happening in my community to people who look like me? And it really sat with me, because I feel the same way. I didn't graduate college that day, but I was teaching that day. What do I say to those students that I've taught? How do we move forward through that? So anybody who's willing to challenge the status quo, in a sense, that just brings me closer to it. And additionally, something that also makes my heart flutter is seeing the optimism of children. Mm-hmm. And so one thing that I remember is we had a workshop at a church, and just seeing so many young children like, just give it up to God. Let me release. God's got us. I'm going to pray for you. All of these kind of messages. And these are babies, you know. So all of those kinds of things, people who are really thinking about the community full circle in a way. That's what messages stand out to me.
And Caitlin, you were doing haikus as well, because
Brendan showed me a video that take me through that was that one of your classes or was that a workshop?
So that was a workshop at Da Vinci High School. So there have been a few days that we've been in schools and have been there the whole day and have kind of gotten students from just throughout the classes, throughout the periods, making cyanotypes. And the first day that we were at Da Vinci High School, literally like maybe 5 minutes before we were about to start, Brendan was like, hey, we should probably do some poetry. And I was like, oh no, all right, let's do it. And so it kind of, we've had the students work together to make haikus in each class. And after that, the haikus themselves can be read as cohesive poems just individually. So it was nice to see how that came together. And it also was kind of like a way to inspire the students. This is how you do this. Mm-hmm. So now go and do it and make something cool out of it. So we've got a full range of feelings. Some students were more militant and pro-Black. Some students were more, let's spread a message of peace and positivity. Some students were like, the community will prevail. You know, again, a full range of emotions throughout this experience, which is all completely valid. And that's one thing that I make sure to say. You don't have to be super positive. You can be upset. You can be confused. You can be angry. You can also feel confused that you don't have anything to say because you weren't affected. That is a part of this whole process too, because a tragedy came into our community and everybody was touched by it. Even one of the students who made a flag, her brother was attacked around the time of the top shooting because he's white. And wow. The guy who attacked him thought that he was the shooter, but is the top shooter going to be in a Tops uniform? Is he going to still be in Buffalo after that happened? You know, not.
But I guess there is still fear of another racist attack because 100%. It's happened throughout our history in this country.
And it just happened to be Black people.
Right.
That doesn't mean that it can't be anybody else. So I would say for anybody listening, be vigilant in all capacities, even if you aren't Black, even if you aren't a person of color, because we're all affected by this.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Ebony, I want to bring you in. Welcome back.
Thank you for having me.
Now, how did you become a facilitator in this initiative?
So I'm pretty well engaged with my community overall. So I was kind of just brought in just as a person that is a connector. But how 514 connects to me, I lost my uncle during 514 as well. And, you know, I think there was some like, is this safe for you to do? Is this okay for you to do, to be in these spaces? As we embark on, you know, 2 years, I will say being in the spaces and engaging with my community overall has been extremely helpful for me. When I look at healing, we talk about this project as being some sort of healing, and healing has pain. Healing has some excitement. So it captures healing in every way. So to even engage with individuals who are still angry, that's part of healing. It's still painful. It's painful for me, but I find that we do this transference in these facilitated groups of hope. So when they look at me, my desire is not to create, if you're mad, I want you to stay mad. But when you see me and they're like, oh, but you're connected, but you're still standing. If that gives you some hope and some inspiration, so be it. Because so many on the outside have given that to me. And that has allowed me to still stand flat-footed, 10 toes down, in the space in which I love. Even as you were sharing the story about the young girl who felt like she was glad that she had to abandon her community. That hurts my heart. Mm-hmm. So on one place, you say, well, I moved to safety, but you have to abandon what is home.
Right.
For me, this is my home. No, home doesn't have everything, all of the bells and the whistles, because we have been disenfranchised and lack of investment, but it's still my home. No one should have to feel safety by leaving their home. And that's a real thing for me.
I want to ask you, being so entrenched in the community, you know, 2 years on from this tragedy, have you seen progress? Have you seen the things that were talked about in the aftermath of the shooting happen?
I've seen a lot of conversation, which everything starts with a conversation.
Yes.
I've seen plans go be written and go into play. But it's been a long time. So before, again, you've heard it before. Before May 14th, we were already in trouble, right? We were already in trouble. The trajectory of where we were heading was really bad. But I think little by little, we're starting to see a little progress because we're starting to call it for what it is. Like, hey, you know, here's the thing. We have this beautiful memorial. We still only have one grocery store. So I'm waiting with all of the investments. You don't have to close that one, but give me more. Mm-hmm. I demand more of you. And I won't minimize feeling like I demand that. My community deserves that because we've been depicted in a way as always being needy, but at the same time, resilient, right?
Always having to turn the
other always cheek. Have to turn the other cheek. That's not true. I demand that from you. My community deserves options. Part of the trauma is not having an option and take what I give you. So I'm patiently waiting. I'm watching. I'm observing. I think like many others for that full investment to give us not just a grocery store, but the experience that many other communities have that they don't have to abandon home or create home somewhere else.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Cheryl, let's bring you in. King Urban Life Center. Now, this group came to you, right, with workshops. Can you talk a little bit about that?
I was looking for something for the community to do involving art. And I reached out to the SEPA Gallery, and Nate told me about this project. And the King Urban Life Center has always been involved with the community. And after 514, we reached out to the seniors who live right around the corner from us and took groceries and supplies to them because now they didn't have anywhere to shop. Mm-hmm. So we've been doing different projects to bring the community in and deal with the mental health issues that are involved around living in the east side of Buffalo. And this looked like the perfect opportunity to allow everyone to create their own type of memorial. So mm-hmm. a big memorial for the community is great, but being able to individualize it and make it personal so that everyone can have their voice about how they're feeling about what happened, and especially the children, because we have an after-school program, and he came and worked with our after-school kids. And on every last Friday, we have a community event, and he's come out a few times to allow the community to create the cenotype flags. And just being able to give everyone a voice for their own memorial, to just release their emotions on canvas. So that's how we came together.
And from your point of view, what was the response like from the kids?
The kids, they really enjoyed the process and being able to say without even words, just with pictures, how they were feeling, because we discussed the bad thing that happened and they all have heard about it because most of them live in the community. But most people don't ask kids how they feel about things. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So talking to them about it and letting them put down on pictures or words if they're able to write, because some of our kids are as young as 5, but just allowing them to speak about how they're feeling. And some kids don't even know how they feel, but they know that this affected their mom, their grandma, and people mm-hmm. were upset. So just being able to create something that expressed my mother was sad and I don't want her to be sad, so I'm going to make this picture for her, and being able to memorialize it on a permanent canvas helped them to, I guess, express more how they felt.
Yeah, and just for clarity, your organization is fairly close to the Tops on Jefferson.
We're about a mile from the Tops. So everyone in that community was affected by, mm-hmm. like she said, only having one option for grocery shopping.
Mm-hmm. Brandon, I want to get back to you. The flags were hung up around Johnny B. Wiley.
Yeah.
And there are flags going up in other parts of the city?
Yes, correct. So we also have some right by the Frank Meriwether Library. And then there's a parking lot right across from the Tops on Jefferson Avenue where flags are on display. And we're continuing to display flags throughout the rest of the city.
Can you talk about the partnership with Roswell, SEPA Art Gallery, and the National Endowment of Arts? And how'd you get those heavyweights to partner with you guys and sponsor this?
I mean, to be honest, just asking and just saying like, hey, you know, like, we're doing this thing, and are there opportunities for us to collaborate together? And so, you know, we're grateful for the NEA and Roswell and SEPA for, you know, giving us that yes. And I think they gave us, in turn, they empowered us. And so in turn, we are empowering the people now to come out and make cyanotype flags with us.
And there'll be more flags in schools? Do I have that right?
Correct. So we've been working alongside Say Yes as well, and we've been having some partnerships with other schools, a part of BPS. But yes, the goal is to go school-wide.
And full clarity, I did make a flag. I didn't even know what I was doing. I was at Klein Hands. I saw my Buff State partner, Caitlin Lowe, and she said, hey, do this. And I said, okay. And then I got the full story that it's a beautiful thing. And our conversation that day was, Caitlin, you and I, you wanted to make 10,000
yes.
of these. 10,000. It's a huge, huge goal. Were you able to make 10,000, or is it, this is a continuing process?
No, this is a continuing process. I think that, honestly, I think that if we were to make 10,000 flags in the few months that I've been a part of this project, I think that we would spontaneously combust. But we are still in the process of making. So if there's anybody who wants to come to a workshop, we're still having them. This is open for everybody to the community. We are in Buffalo Public Schools. We have gone to churches. We have gone to nursing homes. We're trying to impact and at least get the voice of everybody who could have been touched by this tragedy.
So it'll continue on for however long?
So it'll continue along until the funding dries out. When the funding dries out, then we're going to try to figure out how
before,
to
pay. But before it dries out, if there is anyone who desires to sponsor, please contact us, because we don't want it to dry up at all.
No, not at all.
We want to be able to continue to allow community members to leave their mark, their messages throughout the community.
Thank you, Ebony, for that beautiful, shameless plug. Please, if you want to make some beautiful artwork, if you want to be part of a large community endeavor, help us do that, you know?
And so what's next, Cheryl, for the King Life Urban Center?
On May 31st, you talk about a shameless plug. Yes. We are having our Family Fun Friday, and the Blue Flag Project will be there. So if anyone wants to stop in between 5:30 and 7:30, they can come and create their memorial flag at that time. And we're located at 938 Genesee Street. So May 31st, come on down and create your memorial flag.
Ebony, what's next for you? Brandon and Caitlin, what's next?
What's next? I think we continue the initiative and with the 514 memorial that we're working on. And I'm just encouraging everybody from every community to reach out. You know, this is not exclusive to anybody. We all have our own traumas and other pressing issues that we need to address. And so, yes, this is a memorial dedicated to 514, but we also understand that there's a lot of hurting going on throughout the rest of the city, the country, the world. And so we encourage everyone to reach out and collaborate with us.
Could we see more workshops outside of the city in like suburban school districts or suburban churches?
Yeah.
And have those flags fly?
Yeah, I think if they ask in churches, mosques, synagogues, you know, you name it, we're open to it. Certainly.
Yeah, I would agree. I think that for me, I'm definitely trying to figure out ways to use my creative endeavors to embolden this project. I want to figure out ways to add video, to add poetry, more than what we're already doing. I think that every day that I work with this project, it feels like layers are being peeled back. And it feels like a puzzle of grief that we're putting together every single day. And we're trying to find language for it because it's so easy. And I see it all the time to just go through and push because you have to go to work. You've got to pay bills. You've got to eat. How can you sit here and think about a travesty? You're alive. You've got to go and continue to push forward. And I hope that I can help create art that allows people to think about community allows people to just take a step back and get in their feelings. I hate my feelings, but I feel like they're very strong and need to be at the forefront because those emotions come from a very strong place. How do we figure out the root of the problems and how do we create change positively for growth? Mm-hmm.
You're listening to What's Next. I want to thank all my guests, Ebony White, Cheryl Williams Manning, Caitlin Lowe, Brandon Watson, Brendan Bannon, and Joshua Thermidor. This is WBFO News, a part of Buffalo-Toronto Public Media.